House members are present today, Co-Chair Millett, Representative Hughes, myself, Representative Isaacson, and I would also like to recognize our House Recording Secretary is Debbie Tillinghast once again. Thank you for being here. And Heather Parker is our LIO moderator. My co-chair, Millett's Committee 8 is Jeff Turner, and my Committee 8 is Dave Tallarico. And again, I would ask everyone to silence their cell phones. And if anyone's watching online, this is going to be a good presentation. We're going to cover a lot of great information that has been available but is being worked on by Gwen and the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. So at this time, Gwen Holdeman, the Executive Director, if you'd like to come on up, and thank you for being here today. And I wish we had more members here, because I really would like you to talk about how you are working on integrated ways of connecting communities to each other, to opportunities, to markets, how we can really create a sustainable future for Alaska in the energy realm and beyond. Yeah. So thanks so much for being here. And if we have questions, I know we're going to be joined by other members. So if you don't mind, we'll just pop a question here and there. But you do have a lengthy presentation, so I'll let you get going.
And I did, to warn you, I did merge a couple of slides just to try to shorten it a little bit. So.
All right. Let the record show that Representative Neil Foster is here. Thank you, Neil. Go ahead.
And I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here and testify today. It's really fantastic to be back in front of the House Energy Special Committee on Energy. Representative Millett, we've worked together in this venue in the past, and I really commend. I was reviewing the work that was done on HB 306 last night, and looking at where we've made progress, where there's still room for improvement. But this is a committee that's done some real work and some real thinking in exactly what you're talking about. We need to be taking a very holistic approach to these energy issues. We need to be looking at how we can be developing the domestic resources that we have here, and then working on looking at opportunities to really connect that to economic opportunities for our residents. So, when we take a look at some of the where we are right now, and I noticed that you have the energy pathway before you today, and you know, one of the numbers that we tried to come up with when we worked on developing the pathway with the Alaska Energy Authority is how much, if we do nothing today, how much are we on track to spend on energy for Alaskan uses, for our communities, our industries, and our businesses? And these are the numbers that we came up with.
Okay, and just before we get to the numbers, please let the records state that Representative Josephson and Representative Higgins are also here. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And you know, right now we're on track to spend about $5 billion, mainly on diesel fuel in rural Alaska, and about $60 billion in fossil fuels on the rail belt. That's just for fuel costs. It doesn't include additional costs for generating, operating, the maintenance, replacing infrastructure. That's just what we're on track to do right now. And I had a conversation with Representative Edgman, who's also worked quite a lot on energy issues in the state, and he added up what the energy-related appropriations have been since 2008, and they have totaled about $2.3 billion. It's a very substantial investment that we've already made in some of the programs, some of the work that's been done. And, you know, where has that gotten us, and where are we trying to get in the future? And what are really our long-term goals? Is it addressing the cost of energy for our residents? Obviously, that's a huge issue for many of us here in this room and for many communities in the state. But we also want to tie that to economic opportunities. You know, ultimately, if our energy costs are low, but we don't have jobs and opportunities for our children, that's still going to be a challenge for us. And so really tying our energy needs and our opportunities to develop our energy resources to economic opportunities is really what our program at the university is pretty focused on. Our energy challenges here in the state, these are not of a surprise to anyone that's having this discussion here. And these are challenges that transcend whether we're talking about renewables or fossil energy development. We have high energy costs for operating in the state. There is a very fragmented electric grid. This is a really unique circumstance in the United States. In the lower 48 states, they have an integrated electric grid. If you generate power over here, you can send it halfway across the country without problem. We can't do that in this state, and it creates some significant challenges for how we produce and use energy. Harsh climate, it's not so bad here today, but we know that there's real challenges. And in fact, this picture that I have on the slide is an image of one of our researchers that's been working on looking at frazzleite and how that creates challenges for infrastructure development. I was in the community of Igiagic on Lake Iliamna last year, and they actually had a cable that was floated because this ice builds up around infrastructure when the water gets super cooled. It nucleates on anything that it can stick to, and it actually floated this cable and moved a telecommunications cable. And the people that were in charge of that project said, "We had no idea that something like that could occur. You know, this is not something that would be a challenge anywhere other than in the Arctic environment that we have here." So we need to be addressing and recognizing what those problems are. And Alaskans are really good at dealing with those issues. And the supply lines, this is a constant challenge. It's a reality of our location right now in the global economy, but it is something that we may be able to change in the future, or that may be changing for us. Stranded resources, a lot of our resources, especially renewables, aren't necessarily co-located with our population centers. That's just a fact. And a dispersed population. As Representative Isaacson introduced me, I'm the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It's an applied energy research program. We are working on a huge range of energy technologies and options. Again, really looking at how can we take advantage of the university as a resource to be addressing some of these energy challenges. And I'd really like to encourage this committee to use the Alaska Center for Energy and Power as a resource. I know that the House Energy Committee has done that in the past, and we are here to help support you in some of the decision-making, some of the questions as they come up, so please take advantage of that. You know, that's really how we view our role. We are creating information for decision-makers, whether that's here in the legislature or whether that is a community leader or a homeowner. They need good information to make smart decisions about their energy use. And at the same time, we're working with students. We have a lot of students involved in our programs. We're trying to give them opportunities to work with industry on real energy challenges so that they can be prepared for the jobs that exist in the state, so that they're, you know, that there's opportunities for young Alaskans. And commercializing energy information, energy innovation, that's another part of what our program does. Where there's opportunities or there's gaps, we can work with industry to develop solutions to kind of break down barriers for producing energy in the state, and that's something that we've done quite a lot with industry. I was really heartened. I have a lot of letters of support that I've received, and you know, in particular from a couple of industry partners, where you know they feel like their industry would not really be moving forward at the rate that it is without the work that we're doing to make sure that the barriers that they have for implementing certain technologies are reduced. You know. When it comes to partnerships, we build teams. The Alaska Center for Energy and Power has about 30 affiliated faculty on all campuses across the university system. We're not specific to UAF. We have a lot of UAA researchers that work on our research teams. And what we do is we find energy researchers or researchers that might not think of themselves as energy researchers but have skills that are relevant to some of these challenges that we're facing. We bring them together in teams to address specific problems. Some of our researchers work with ASAP on every project they do. Some of them might come in one time on a very specific project, say a fish biologist working with us on river hydrokinetics, and that's the only energy research they do. And they're energy researchers, and there's a lot of resources that the university has to offer, and I think we can leverage that to help work on addressing some of these issues. We also work very closely with industry. On one side here are partners within the university system that we have researchers that are engaged with our program. On the other side are a sample of some of our industry partners. We do almost no projects without working with industry partners. We collaborate very, very closely with the utility industry, with communities in the state, and with businesses that are working on energy issues. I put in two slides for Representative Foster last night, so these are not in your packet, but after our conversation, I thought an illustrative example is from Nome, and we were having this conversation yesterday. We pulled together a team of researchers at the university that had expertise and had developed a new technique for remote sensing for volcanoes and for underground fires in coal mines. And we thought that this is something that could be applied to geothermal exploration. One of the challenges with geothermal exploration, and you know, we have a new lease sale that's going to be that's underway in the state right now, the costs of exploration are incredibly high. And this is something that Ormat has really struggled with the Mount Spur project. I think they're still quite committed to moving forward on that. But it is a real challenge. And if we can reduce the cost of exploration, it's a game changer for geothermal. And so we developed this technique at the Geophysical Institute at UAF, ASAP, worked with those researchers to figure out a way to fund this, to apply it to geothermal energy. The Department of Energy funded that research, and it could have been done anywhere. But we chose to do it in Alaska, and we chose to do it at Pilgrim Hot Springs because we also thought that that was a resource that had potential to actually be developed to generate power for Nome. And so that's an example where we're bringing together geologists, you know, geophysicists, volcanologists that don't think of themselves as energy researchers on a daily basis, but they're working in teams with ASAP, and that's a project that we've had some very positive results, and there's a lot of interest in potentially moving forward with the next steps of that project. And again, just continuing that same line of thought, this remote sensing technique that we developed, we can apply this to new energy challenges in the state. These are not researchers that think of themselves as energy researchers again, but we're saying, hey, you've developed this remote sensing technique. How can we do a better job addressing the question of the, you know, poor infrastructure in homes and buildings throughout the state? You know, we have invested a lot of money into trying to improve weatherization. That's a big part of that, $2.3 billion that we've spent as a state. How can we do a more holistic approach to addressing where the biggest problems are? And so this is a remote sensing technique could do that.
Gwen, please break out the acronym FLIR.
Yeah, I apologize for that. It stands for forward-looking infrared radiometry. It is infrared imaging, okay? And it isn't really about the fact that you're taking infrared images. That's the unique thing that we've done. What we're doing is processing it so you can actually get real data from that. It's not just, oh, look, it's hot there, but what does that mean? Like, how hot? Could you develop that? Where should you drill? Where are the best targets for addressing poor, you know, issues with weatherization in homes? Community-wide. You can fly over a community and address the entire community in one shot.
Excellent. And Representative Higgins.
So by that picture right there, it's really an awesome picture, by the way. Is that just one house that's energy efficient? The rest of the four there are red tops are producing a lot of heat loss?
There is not one particular home there that is particularly energy efficient. That is an example, and it's not, I should be careful to say that this is from Calgary. It's not from our university.
Oh.
We operate very much on external grants and contracts. We don't have a substantial amount of base funding from the state, and so we can't do a high degree of work unless we are able to find some kind of external grant and contract. And so this is an example of something we've been looking at. We've been tweaking and testing the technique, but we haven't had funding to do that in Alaska.
And we might mention UAV is unmanned aerial vehicles, so these are little aircraft that are flying around with these heat sensors, so it doesn't really cost a lot of money to do this. It's also something that we might be able to work in connection with military and other applications up here, which would enhance your surveys as well throughout Alaska.
That's exactly right. This body actually funded some research for unmanned aerial vehicles at the university last year, and we are now partnering with that program to figure out how can we apply unmanned aerial vehicle to energy research in the state. And the idea of looking at homes, we are going to be flying a UAV survey at Pilgrim Hot Springs to, again, take the research we're doing in next summer. So we're always looking for opportunities to work with other people that have ideas that we can apply to our energy problems in this state. That's what we do. There's three areas that we work on. ASAP is really organized around providing answers for communities. How can we best manage our energy supply and demand for our communities? But again, we really want to be tying that to economic development in this state. It doesn't really matter if your energy is free if you don't have a job. I mean, it's really about economic development. That's what we're talking about. And so that's where powering the economy is really where we want to be going. How do we power our economy not just today, but into the future. And that's really what we're looking at, is more long-range thinking. Where do we want to be going? Let's look at this very holistically. Where are the opportunities for the state? Where are the opportunities for our residents today and tomorrow? And the same thing, energy field of the future. Now, we need to be looking at not just how we're extracting our resources today for export, but how are we going to be doing that tomorrow? Are there more difficult to extract resources that are still going to provide value in the future when the technology comes along? This is a picture of methane hydrates. We have some of the best methane hydrate resources in the world onshore, which is a very unusual occurrence because we have it locked into the permafrost. It dwarfs the amount of oil that exists in the world. You know, this is a big resource, and I believe someday it's going to be developed. The question is when, where, and Alaska is one of the places that this could and has been done first. We've been a pioneer. BP has done a lot of work in this area in Alaska. We have, at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, I mentioned that we're funded primarily through external grants and contracts and partnerships. We have about $18 million in 20 active projects right now.
Mr. Chairman, just to make this...
One second. Sure. Let me recognize you. Again, okay. We do this for the folks. If you have something, let me intrude at a time that's appropriate for the presenter. Representative Josephson.
Sorry to interrupt you. Just a truly a housekeeping measure. I'm trying to take this document and line it up with the PowerPoint, and I'm not able to do it. Is this a different thing than what we have? And that's fine if it is. I'll stop sort of.
Yeah, I need to apologize for that. I received the friendly criticism yesterday. Okay. I had a few too many slides, and what I've done is try to merge it.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. I
do apologize. I haven't changed any of the material, but it's been reorganized just a little bit. So the PowerPoint that you have printed out there, it's the same material, but it's slightly
not
different.
A problem.
Look.
Just
so
wanted
I do
to just,
apologize.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead. Thank you.
But, you know, what I think is important to grasp is we often think about, oh, the university is a, you know, we are funding the university to do these things, to educate young Alaskans, to do whatever we need the university to do. But there are also programs like ours. We are actually a revenue source for the university as well. We are bringing in a significant amount of funding that does fund the university, base funds the university, beyond what we're receiving from the state. So as we are able to grow, it provides a sustainable funding source for the university as well. And so I really want to make that case. We're not just looking at driving economic development in our communities, but at the university too. This is an opportunity for us by really taking advantage and leveraging the resources we have here. We put together these teams. We're able to successfully compete for funding from a wide range of sources, working again with our counterparts at UAA. We're submitting a proposal with the Institute for Social and Economic Research, ICER, today to Department of Energy. But that's a perfect example. Department of Energy, when we approached them about working with ICER on a project, they said, we have never funded social scientists before, ever. And we said, you know, the social science component is really critical in Alaska. And we pioneered that, bringing in social scientists to work with engineers and technical people. And they are looking at our project now as a pioneering example of how to do more holistic research. And so that's what we do. And we're doing that pretty successfully. The program's about 5 years old. Like I mentioned, we have about 30 faculty members that are working on our projects right now, 16 staff, both in Anchorage and Fairbanks. And this is just another snapshot of where this is projects that we have that are statewide that we've had over about the last 2 or 3 years. We work all over the state and on a wide range of different topics. We've recently done some work on small modular nuclear reactors, looking at that. That's something that's been of interest in the past to Alaska. We're looking at both fossil and renewable resources. Whatever we can do to develop our resources to benefit our residents and find new opportunities for economic development. We do have some comparative advantages in the state, and that's where I think we need to figure out, that's where we focus. You know, we can't do everything. For one example would be, we do a lot of work in advanced battery technologies, advanced storage technologies. It's a place where Alaska's been a leader. We have the largest battery system in the world up in Fairbanks at Golden Valley. But we're not going to be generating or developing the new generation of energy storage technologies here in the state. We're not going to do that. But we do have the opportunity to test those kinds of technologies in a way that we can take advantage of them. But we're not focusing on actually building new battery systems here.
Gwen, let me ask you to clarify. Why are you saying that we will not? Isn't that limiting our
yeah.
view? At this moment, perhaps the economics aren't there to do it, but
yeah.
do you foresee someday if energy programs succeed and we actually have affordable energy that would incentivize private investment, you could actually, with your range of scientists and others at the university or throughout the state, pull together a team that actually yeah. could do some of this research?
Yeah. That would be my dream. The reality is that, you know, right yeah. now there are millions and millions and millions of dollars being spent on developing new storage technologies in this country and outside of this country. And at this point in time, there isn't that kind of level of support, and there's not that kind of level of activity in Alaska. I do believe Alaska can become a leader in some of these areas, but if we focus first in the areas where we do have a comparative advantage, I think that that's where we can start to really leverage that and build some momentum and develop a center of excellence here. You know, North Dakota has one of the largest research programs in the world. North Dakota.
I know, and I got chewed by the late Senator Stevens for not pushing the university hard enough when the nanotechnology funds
yeah.
came, and we were dragging our feet. And then I got chewed by then President Hamilton for interfering, so I got caught in the between. But I want the record and this committee to remember, and you also, please take note, UCOR is developing heavy strategic metals, and part of those strategic metals are for batteries and other high-end applications that of such that you're talking about. And so we are on the very edge of being able to do exactly what you envision. That's why I reacted at the moment. Just keep that vision alive, and whatever can be done anywhere else in the world, we have the resources and the brain power to eventually do right here in Alaska.
You're absolutely right. And those raw materials that we need to be developing those systems, we have, 150 different occurrences of rare earth minerals in the state. I mean, we have a huge opportunity. It's a whole another niche area that we could really be and are starting to move forward in developing. So there's a lot of very related opportunities here. So. High contribution renewables. This is something where, because we have these small islanded electric grids, we have a unique problem. When we look at bringing geothermal online and combining that with wind power for Nome, it creates some real technical challenges. And that's not limited to communities like Nome. The same issue is happening on a rail belt. You know, when Golden, that's part of why we have the best system in Fairbanks. That's part of why, when we're looking at having independent power producers come onto our electric grid, it's a challenge for our utilities. We have a very islanded and small and fragmented grid, and it is a challenge at all levels in the state. And that is the kind of thing that is a challenge, but because we are getting very good at addressing that issue, it's something that the rest of the country and world is paying attention to. We are considered the leader right now on integrating diesel engines with wind systems in Alaska. The world leader. And that's exciting, because I think there's a lot of room for improvement there too. But as we get better, you know, we have an opportunity to really be developing small opportunities and industries around those kinds of technologies, just starting to focus on that. And that's the kind of thing where our program, we're trying to increase opportunities for that kind of work to be done here in Alaska. I provided a handout that shows the lab that we have in Fairbanks, and I know most of you haven't had a chance necessarily to visit our facility in Fairbanks. If you do come up there, we would be very interested in giving you a tour. It is the only facility like it in the world, and it recreates an entire village right in our lab, an entire full power system for like this island and microgrid, including all of the problems that you have with that, with faults and unbalanced phases and all of the problems. And we can test new ideas, new technologies, new strategies for integrating different kinds of power generation. We have a wind turbine in our lab, just the motor and the generator set. We can program that with a wind signal from any community in the state, any community. So we can recreate any problem that's happening in the state, in our lab, and figure out how to fix that there, where the costs of failure are not high. And that's the kind of thing that I think the university has a role, and industry has been incredibly supportive of that concept. There's a couple that we have I'll go into a little more, low temperature geothermal, hydrokinetics. It's an area where industry has been interested in working in Alaska, and how can we capitalize on that? Difficult to extract and transport fossil fuels, and in value-added processing, how can we export our energy in ways other than through pipelines and transmission lines, which is, you know, often what the conversation is about. But how can we do more value-added processing? How can we make sure that more wealth stays here in Alaska that's tied to those resources before we export them? So I mentioned that Alaska is a pioneer in high contribution renewables and island energy systems. The world is becoming gradually more and more electrified. Now, Chris Rose likes to say that there's currently 2 billion people worldwide without access to reliable electric power. I haven't been able to verify that number, but I believe it. And when you look at this world at night map, I think it does kind of illustrate that there are a lot of places where there's very large populations that do not have access to electric power today. But those places are going to be coming online. And the way that they're coming online in terms of just power generation is going to be a lot more similar to what's happening in Alaska than to what's happening in the lower 48. They're not going to come on and build an entire grid network across Africa tomorrow. It's going to happen in a patchwork network of different energy systems, and they're going to have the same kind of challenges that we have here in Alaska. It's an opportunity for us, I believe, to really look at how we can apply what we're learning here to business opportunities in other places in the world. And then this is a picture of our lab. So again, this lab is really a tool for industry to use. We've had a huge amount of interest from all kinds. Boeing, for example, has been very interested in testing an advanced flywheel that they have up here in our lab, looking at the integration issues. We're a friendly test facility. We want these projects to succeed. And so we work with industry, test it here in the lab, tweak it. We had an inverter system that is out in Coconuck right now, also on Lake Iliamna. They have had some issues with a wind system that they have out there and an inverter system. We set up the exact same setup on our test bed, brought in the manufacturer, fixed the algorithms that the programming that was problematic in our lab, tested it across the whole range of what might happen in Coconuck, and then they went out in the community and did the same fix. And it was a really effective use of our test bed, and in this case, Marsh Creek was very appreciative of the opportunity to have this facility. So, but it's brand new, so we expect that it's going to be getting a lot of use over the next few years. Hydrokinetics, you know, extracting energy directly from rivers and tidal basins. This is something that's been of interest in Cook Inlet. It's of interest in a lot of our rural communities as well. It's challenging. It's one of these things where there is a huge degree of industry interest in coming here and piloting projects in Alaska. Of the emerging energy technology grant fund applications, about 20% of them were for hydrokinetic ocean and river technologies, which was really disproportionate, you know, compared to where a lot of that. But it shows that there's a huge degree of interest here. And so the way our program, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, works with industry is we're not building a new turbine, okay? But what we're doing is we are building devices that are going to make these things possible to operate in Alaska. And so that is addressing the problem with debris and ice. And so this particular turbine was installed in Eagle. This is a picture from Eagle. It's actually tipped up out of the water. So normally it's tipped down into water. The picture on the bottom right-hand side is a turbine that was installed in Ruby. And you can see that that is a bunch of logs and debris that is built up against the front of that turbine. That is a huge operating challenge, and I think anybody can see that. On the left-hand side, that is a device that we developed and tested last summer in Nenana. We have a test site in Nenana. It worked very well. I'm more optimistic about hydrokinetics today than I was a year ago. And the reason is because we were able to effectively deploy this thing through an entire field season and not have any issues with debris, even in high water times and when there was a lot of debris. And we tried to break it. So,
Gwen, how much electricity is this one that you've actually made succeed? And then I take it you're taking it out of the ice during the wintertime, so what's the season range? How many months?
That's an excellent question, and that's why hydrokinetics, there's limits to this technology. They're not going to operate under the ice, and it isn't even because they couldn't technically operate, but there's not enough flow in the winter It's not about water depth. It's about, is there much movement? And there's not, there's no runoff in the winter. There's not much less flow. You couldn't operate most of these in the winter. So you're looking at taking them in and out, you know, before and after breakup. And the other challenge with these is looking at how they could impact the outmigration of smolt. And that's another thing. Like, we have looked, we've studied adult fish a lot in the state, but we haven't studied when the smolt migrate out. And the last thing we want to do, they're going to go out in the fastest part of the river channel, which is exactly where you want to be harvesting energy. And so how do we address that? And how do we make sure that we're not, you know, hurting our fish population by trying to address our energy issue? But yes, in Eagle, this was a 25-kilowatt unit, which produced a little bit over half of the community's energy needs when it was operating. But they are not operating any longer because they had these issues with debris that they did not feel it was commercial. And so they turned over the equipment that they have and the remaining funds to the Alaska Center for Energy and Power to address these barriers to development. And I wish I have letters of support. This industry is very excited about the work that we've done because they feel like without this work, they would be much further behind in what they're doing. So, yeah. I also want to mention that this isn't that we think of being from Fairbanks. I think of the Yukon and the Tannen a lot, but this is the same kind of technology that you would deploy. And don't look at this one turbine. There's lots of different ways that you can extract energy. It's the same. We're working with the same people that are looking at Cook Inlet tidal. There's opportunities all over the state for that. And there's also river systems in the state that don't have debris issues the way some of the interior or ice issues the way we do in the interior. Low temperature geothermal. This is an area where in some ways we've missed an opportunity. This is the very first low temperature geothermal system in the entire world was installed in Alaska. And most people think that would be Chena Hot Springs, but it wasn't. It was a system that was installed in Manly. This is now this is a giant industry worldwide. These systems, this particular company, Ormat, we're familiar with them now because of the Mount Spur project most recently, but it's come really full circle. They launched their geothermal company in Alaska, testing their technology at Manly Hot Springs. And so we have opportunities here. The Chena Hot Springs system is the lowest temperature operating geothermal system in the entire world. This is an area where Alaska's been held up as a pioneer in this kind of technology, but we're not really taking advantage fully of that for, you know, driving economic opportunities here in the state. And that's the kind of thing where I would like to see more of that done. And so at the university, we've taken it one step further. We're using the same kind of technology which can use low-quality heat. So whether that's from a geothermal system, that's about the same temperature as your cup of hot coffee there, or maybe that it was this morning, or whether that's waste heat from a diesel engine. You know, when you have a diesel generator, you only use about one-third of the energy content in a gallon of diesel fuel for generating electricity. The rest of it goes out as heat, and we have an opportunity to capture that and use that to generate more power or heat homes.
Excellent. You mentioned that we're not taking economic advantage. What do you see the next step, and how would the legislature help move this along, since we do have a lot of geothermal opportunity in Alaska?
We do have resources. They're not really co-located with our populations, and that's a real challenge for geothermal in the state. I would love to see a project developed at Mount Spur. I think the Aleutians have world-class potential. I think Nome has some real potential. But there's a handful of places in the state right now that we can really look at developing geothermal. But this idea of using low-quality heat, and that can be from industrial processes or geothermal, that's an example of where Alaskan ingenuity could really be driving this and then looking to seed opportunities in other places. And, you know, we recently participated in a policy tour to Iceland. And Iceland's been talked about a lot for geothermal. But what was really intriguing to me, and we brought some students along, and they did papers. They did policy papers. And I just read one of the policy papers 2 days ago from one of our students. And he made the observation that is absolutely correct. They fund students to come to Iceland for a free education from places that have high geothermal resource potential in the developing world. So if you're from East Africa and you want a free education in geothermal, Iceland will pay for your education. And it's, why would they do that? What's their benefit to that? But what they're doing is they're basically creating a pipeline. When that person's educated and becomes a project champion back in East Africa because they know what's going on in geothermal, where are they going to go? They're going to go to Iceland for expertise. They're going to bring in Icelandic companies, and they're going to go there, and they're going to develop that project. They're going to work hand in hand with local people in East Africa to develop those projects. And so they're creating this natural network for industry in Iceland through educational opportunities to have opportunities for new development elsewhere. And that is the kind of thing that I think that's a pretty out there model, right? I don't think we're going to be bringing people to Alaska and offering them a free education that are from Pacific Islands, you know. But still, it's the concept is important. If we can bring people here, we are, for example, right now, this high contribution renewables, we are the leaders. We're perceived as the leaders. I want to see us bringing people here from around the world, learning from the businesses in Alaska that are dealing with these issues, and then bring those businesses back to other places so they can build up a lot more competency and offer new opportunities for our young people. That's what I would like to see.
All right.
Is that kind of a long answer?
That helps to point us in that direction. So in summary, a lot of it is two things. One, not only do we have the ability to connect our communities, and we're going to have a presentation from AVEC about possibly stretching lines throughout Alaska, but you're seeing more the opportunity to export our expertise around the world and create an industry based here, and we can further that through education.
I mean, our top priority is to address our energy needs here. But if we can do that and leverage that, fix our problems here and figure out ways to export that, I think there's an opportunity there. I mentioned methane hydrates. This is just a slide representing that. We're not just talking about renewables here. Now, there are a lot of very difficult to extract fossil fuel resources too: heavy oil, methane hydrates, underground coal gasification. These are things that are not commercial technologies today, but are there things that would be a game changer for Alaska, and are things that I think we should be keeping an eye on, because they're going to provide new opportunities for us in the state to continue to export our higher value resources. And here's just another picture, just taking a broader look at the state of Alaska. I mentioned earlier we're at the end of supply routes, but you know, last year 46 ships took the Northern Sea Route. It's a tenfold increase since 2010. I mean, you guys are not unfamiliar with this fact, and this is a big deal. This is happening, right? This is happening no matter what we do. So the question is, you know, if there's only a 50 ship a year increase over the next decade, we're talking 500 ships. Now that may or may not happen. It's hard to say. But if it does, we should be looking at how we can capitalize on that, because all of a sudden we're much more connected to a lot of resources. The mineral resources, many of the discoveries are going to be made in the Arctic and are going to be coming past Alaska. They already are. So how do we capitalize on that? How could we potentially develop some of our stranded resources, like in the Aleutians, to take advantage of, again, value-added processing of some of these materials? That's a possibility. Just another thing Iceland's done, right? They've done it very well. So it's just another thing to be thinking about when you're trying to connect things on a broader level. And this is what this committee, I believe, has done in the past, is not just looking at energy for individual communities, but how can we look at it in a broader context of where we're going, you know, not just today, but in 10 or 20 or 50 years, and how do we kind of move forward in a way that really is to the maximum benefit of all of us in our future. So again, we've been a leader in some areas. I mentioned low temperature geothermal. We've got the largest battery system in the world in Fairbanks. Core drilling technique that's been used for exploration all over the world. It was pioneered in Alaska. Thermosiphons for extracting heat. They are, you know, the uprights that you see on the pipeline. That was pioneered in Alaska at UAF. There's a lot of areas that we've pioneered different energy technologies, and I think we can continue to do that. I think that the university has a big role in trying to make that happen. So how can we support you? I mean, ultimately, I really do want to, again, state that I encourage you to use us as a resource. We're here as a resource for you. We want to help you answer some of the tough questions that are before you today. And that's, you know, the basically what we can do is assess different technology options. We've done that quite a lot. Small modular reactors is a good example. This is a Toshiba 10-megawatt reactor that was proposed for Galena almost a decade ago now. But that actually is another example where we actually drove, Alaska drove forward the entire conversation about small modular nuclear reaction at the national level because there was a site that had been proposed to install one of these. And that's not, that project's not moving forward. This is the kind of technology we should keep an eye on. You know, it's not that you can't buy one today, but if you could, it would be worth considering. We should keep our minds open. Data collection analysis, how are our investments doing? You know, we've invested $2.3 billion, a lot of that's in energy projects. How are they performing? Where do you want to invest in the future? You know, we don't go back that much and look at which projects are really performing well, exceeding our expectations, and where do we have work to do so we can make that good decisions moving forward. And that's the kind of thing a university can do. We don't have funding to do that right now, but we would like to do more of that. And then energy analysis. This is an area that I really think the university could do more in. ICERT's done a lot of work in this area. I have a colleague with me here today somewhere, Anthony Scott. He's a faculty member with UAF. He's located in Anchorage, and he's done some work on energy analysis, looking at the Fairbanks market, for example. I think that's the kind of thing that the university can contribute more to. And then looking at scenarios planning, let's project out possible different future options for Alaska. This is kind of a decision-making tool that's been developed by the University of Alaska Fairbanks for looking at actually shipping in the Arctic. And I want to apply that to energy now. Okay, so how do we look at all the possible things that could happen? And what are the wild cards that might occur? And where is that going to get us? And then how can we kind of tweak the path to choose the most optimal route for Alaska? So that's the kind of thing that we can get involved in. And I think you guys do have a funding request we have in the capital budget. It's part of the university's capital budget request to support these kinds of things that we can work more closely with you on the things that we think matter and that you think matter, and not just where we have a grant from Department of Energy. So I think that's it. So thank you.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do want to thank you, Gwen, very much for you know, the work you're doing, especially all around the state, but specifically in Nome with regard to the Pilgrim project and the geothermal. And from what I understand, she spent many, many a night in a cabin or a tent up there in Nome. And so my thought was that maybe it was a program that was administered out of Fairbanks there, but boy, I tell you, they get their hands dirty. They get out there and sloshing in the mud and so forth. So I really appreciate that. One of the things that came up in my discussion when I had the opportunity to speak with Gwen was, I think, a policy decision that we're going to have to keep in mind, and that is, if you look at a community, for example, that pays a rural community that pays say 40 cents a kilowatt hour, that's before PCE, and then say PCE kicks in and that gets you down to, I'm just making up numbers here, but 20 cents per kilowatt hour, but you've got a renewable energy project that could bring energy independence to that rural community, but that's going to get you down to 21 cents. You know, if I'm in Nome and I'm saying, well, you know, with PCE, I'm able to just pay 20 cents. Why would I want to do a project that's going to, just get us down to 21 cents? You know, on the one hand, PCE is kind of creating a disincentive to want us to do that project. But from the state's perspective, it's a great project because it's saving the state from having to pay, you know, the difference, which is the difference between the 40 cents and the 21 cents, the 19 cents. So it's a good thing. So I'm just trying to, you know, think of what types of mechanisms we need to be thinking about in order to, you know, create the incentive there. And again, the goal of the rural community is going to be, you know, you never know if PECE is going to be here today and gone tomorrow. So that's definitely one incentive to want to do a project like that. And I don't know if you've had a chance to think more about that, but I guess any thoughts on that?
It's a really astute observation, and clearly you are well versed in the way the PCE formula is calculated. It includes the power cost equalization program. You know, looks at the average cost of energy in Fairbanks, Juneau, and Anchorage, and then has a formula where they're basically subsidizing communities that have higher energy costs, primarily diesel communities. The problem is that there's both a fuel and a non-fuel component to the way it's calculated. And a fuel component, once you start reducing the fuel use in a community, then you are actually getting less subsidy. And that's a challenge with the way it's calculated. And there's there's disagreement on whether that disincentivizes development of renewable energy projects. However, what I don't think there's disagreement on is the fact that it does mean that the benefits for these projects is often going back to the PCE program and not getting back to the individual residents of those communities. And that, I think, is something that this committee could take a closer look at, because it's an issue. You know, we think, oh, we built a wind farm in this community, those guys have lower cost power now, and that is not necessarily accurate. We may have reduced their PCE subsidy, so the state's benefited from that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the ratepayers have a lower cost on our utility bill. So I'm glad that you brought that up. It's a really astute observation, and I think the PCE program deserves to be looked at again in light of the fact that we're investing a lot of projects that are offsetting fuel in these communities.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? My co-chair is brimming.
Oh no, I spend a lot of time with Gwen. I love this presentation because there's so many opportunities that we as Alaskans don't think about. But Gwen, and I don't know if people know, but Gwen helped develop the Chena Hot Springs technology. And so, I mean, I spent some time up in Fairbanks with Gwen and just was blown away. And Emerging Technology Fund came out of one of those visits. So we've spent a lot of time, and I think it's just amazing. And so I think the new committee members would benefit more from asking questions than I would, because...
And we're going to have more information coming back from AEA. We're also going to have lessons from Iceland and others from Institute of the North coming up. And so I noticed that you had put some in there.
Yeah, I removed those slides when I heard that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And then building on the work that this committee has done, since 5 of 7 members are new, we need to make sure that we do some of this reading. So there's a Wiki Energy Energy Wiki article that will be distributed talking about some of the history. There's also a report from 1985. It's an 80-page report. It looks like it was written just yesterday. We'll get you some of the 2004 reports, 2003. Representative Millett, co-chair, passed out action that this committee did in 2008, 2010. I hope you've looked at that. We need to really be looking at it, though, and what this presentation, Gwen, has brought forward really does challenge us to go beyond some of these things. It's not just conservation. That's a great, plaudable policy, but as you open it up, even if it's free, if there's no jobs, you're not going to be there. Our task is, as legislators, we're to encourage the settlement of the land, developing the resources to help us do that. Yes, there's a conservation model, but it's maximum use, maximum benefit, and one of the foundational keys is having energy that attracts private investment, and you've shown us some little roots, and like Co-Chair Millett said, there is a lot of meat in this presentation, and if we wanted to dig in, there's a lot of tentacles that could help us figure out how to connect communities to each other, to economic opportunity, and to the resources around them. So also in front of you is the Pathways presentation. This is an encyclopedia of opportunity, but as we were talking about before the committee began, it's looking at communities in isolation. And one of the things that you brought up is how we can maybe look at communities in a synthetic, holistic approach. And we need to do that as the next step in our policy evolution. And so I would encourage you, Gwen, with ASAP, bring us this information. Bring us some of the keys where you see us, in the legislative role, needing to go for doing exactly what we're talking about, and as I've summarized. So I like the idea about the investment performance and analysis of PC. If we could, if you have any thoughts on that, that would be something we'll go back to AEA as well.
I should mention that ICER did a pretty good study on looking at ways to potentially restructure the PCE program, so that would be a report that might be worth grabbing.
Is that a recent report?
Yeah. Okay. It's Institute for Social and Economic Research. It's about a year old, I'd say. I'd be happy to forward it to you.
Please do. Yeah, and then we'll distribute that out. Appreciate that. Well, if there's no other business at this time, we will adjourn today's meeting, the House Special Committee Energy, at 9:52, and we'll come back. Next meeting is
8:52.
8:52.
Monday, probably. Monday.
And no, Monday we're both gone. So probably next Wednesday. So 8:52, we are adjourned.